Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
My name is I always have a happy thought before I get ready to come down to Kanando. I always enjoy coming. Very peaceful down here. And thanks for you guys coming and taking the time out. I know you have other things to do. Taking the time to come to Kanando and listen to my talk, and those of you online too, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Could you ask them if they're having problems hearing you?
Are you hearing all right online? They're having problems. If I raise my voice up, is that helping, or it's maybe technically a problem?
It is spot on. It is on? Yeah. Okay.
Can you try it now?
How about now? No. Still no.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
I want to make sure you're on there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's see if you just chosen.
Yeah, wireless go.
Mm-hmm. Hold on just a minute. Let me do a restart.
They seem to think now we've got it.
You got it?
Right? Now. You can hear now? Oh, Dan, there's you on the screen. That's odd. I thought you were here.
Can you hear?
Oh, there's me too. Oh, that's even odder, yeah.
Can you hear?
Are we good?
No?
Yeah.
Okay,
now you're hearing. Yes.
We don't know how we fixed it.
Okay, you don't know. That's how it always goes, yeah.
I'm sorry.
Now you must have turned it off.
Did I?
Yes.
Okay, I'm just going to pull the lavalier off. And people here online? Yeah.
Yes. There you go. Okay. All right. Okay. Well, this morning I want to continue a discussion that I started about a month ago about the Gandavyuha Sutra, which is the 39th and final chapter of a much longer sutra called the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Flower Garland Sutra. And that is one of the most extensive and far out of all Mahayana sutras. It's, I don't know, a couple thousand pages long. And it depicts a vast, almost incomprehensibly vast, in fact, I would say exactly incomprehensibly vast world, full of infinite numbers of Buddhas on every single atom in multiple world systems, and on each, serving each Buddha is a retinue of bodhisattvas and others, and they're all tirelessly practicing on behalf of sentient beings whom they love and want to protect. That's the world of the Avatamsaka Sutra. And it is far beyond the objective world that we think we live in. And yet, as our Chan ancestors proposed, that vast world is also identical with this objective material world. It's not a different world. It's the essence, it's the fundamental truth of the material world, and that's the process of our practice, to see that and to feel that in our living. Although at first it might seem as if the world of the sutra is fantasy land and completely irrelevant to the problems we have right now, I don't think so. In tough times, it is important to know how to keep our head above water and how to live in the world with our eyes open to the real problems and do whatever we can about them, but at the same time, not be limited to our small views, and to understand that human goodness, cosmic goodness, and the possibility of love and creativity is always right there, if we are open to it. And when times are tough, it's very easy to find that you can't be open to it. So that's why it's worthwhile to contemplate this sutra. This sutra and other teachings like it are really telling us that there is never a sufficient reason to lose hope, because hope is built into the nature of reality itself. No matter what happens, no matter what seems to be going on, the nature of reality itself has built into it hope. And the Avatamsaka Sutra is one of the world's greatest religious visions of such goodness and such hopefulness. And so to study it in these times is really inspiring and sustaining. We've studied this sutra before, some time ago, but this time around, we began about a month ago at the beginning of this month, and I know some of you have been attending our Everyday Zen Dharma seminars on this topic, and so you're familiar with the sutra already. And if you would like to join us, if you're not familiar with it and you want to join us, you're welcome to join. We meet every Wednesday from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific time. Every second and fourth Wednesday of the month, we meet also in person and online. And all the talks, including this one, are recorded and posted so that if you miss one or you missed all the other ones, you could actually listen to them and catch up if you want to. And everything that you need to know to access any of this is easily found on the Everyday Zen website, which is everydayzen.org. So the Gandavyuha is the final chapter of the sutra. It's sort of the culmination of all the teachings of the sutra. It's the longest chapter of the sutra. This is how big it is in book form. This is one chapter of 39. And the Gandavyuha is the story of a pilgrimage of an enthusiastic Dharma student named Sudana, who visits 59 spiritual benefactors for teachings. And he eventually ends up in the vast tower called the Realm of Reality, which is the ultimate realm of truth shared by all the Buddhas. And the 59 benefactors are all very different, one from another. Some of them are monks, some of them are nuns, some of them are eminent wealthy people, some of them are kings. There's one grammarian that we heard about last week, a couple weeks ago. There's one who's a perfumer. Old men, young men, women, old women, young women, girls, all kinds of people. All kinds of situations in which Sudana encounters them. And each one of them is possessed with fabulous wisdom and mystical powers that they describe. And each one of them, although they appear to exist in the regular world, actually exist in vast worlds within worlds of insight and vision. And each one, at the end of their teaching, is also humble enough to say that, you know, that's what I have realized, but there's so much more. I know nothing about so and so and so on. So you go forth to the next spiritual benefactor who can tell you more. And Sudana will go on to study with the next one for further instructions. Since Sudana has set his sights on complete awakening for the benefit of all beings, he is full of energy and enthusiasm. And he's always asking, how do bodhisattvas practice? What do they need to know? No matter how many teachers he visits, He's always starting at the beginning, always full of innocence and passion to do all that can be done to awaken on behalf of everyone. Because all bodhisattvas know, and this is what makes them bodhisattvas, that it is impossible to awaken alone. That all awakening is awakening together with everyone and everything. That's the only kind of awakening there is. And that's why compassion is naturally the hallmark of bodhisattva practice, including in Zen. Although in Zen, being a Chinese version of all this, and therefore kind of down to earth and practical, you don't hear this directly. It's very modest and understated, but it's the same practice. In my previous talks, I've been constantly amazed at how great this sutra is, how cosmic and inspiring. But in my talk today, I'm finding some problems and difficulties with the sutra, which in itself, I think, is interesting. If we are going to be honest people, and we're not going to suspend our intelligence when we study spiritual teachings, we will, from time to time, notice that we have problems with the teachings. So that's sort of an interesting thing, right? If you're honest about it, what do you do about that? What do you do when it looks like there's a problem with a teaching that you're really trying to take to heart? When you hear something that doesn't sound right, or even worse than that, that you find absolutely repugnant, what do you do about that? Do you trust your point of view and reject the teaching? But maybe your point of view is wrong, however much doesn't seem wrong to you. Maybe it is wrong. I mean, do we really know we're right about things, however much we feel we are? Maybe you're wrong and the teaching is right. So then you're going to override your point of view and force yourself to accept the teaching, or sort of pretend that you accept the teaching, brainwash your own self to do that. Could you do that? Is that even possible? I suppose it is possible, but if it is possible, I don't think it's such a great idea, really. You know? Something distorted about that. I mean, we see people doing that, and it doesn't look right. It doesn't feel right. So what will we do? Just sort of like forget about it and go on? So anybody who's really going to be honest about their religious practice is going to find from time to time such a problem. Because every one of our great religions is based on ancient teachings, and all those ancient teachings are embedded necessarily in social contexts that are very, very different from ours. So this is sort of like something that people who are committed to their religious traditions are always grappling with one way or the other. How do you square the teachings with the times you live in? And this is not really a simple problem. So I'm finding that in the passage that I'm going to share with you this morning. So here's the passage. I'll read it from the sutra. Sudana goes to visit a spiritual benefactor named Ratnachuda. And Ratnachuda is a very wealthy and eminent person who lives in a place called Sinapota City. And here's what happens when Sudana encounters him, and you'll get a good, those of you who are unfamiliar with the sutra, will get a flavor of the way the language of the sutra goes. So Sudana was looking all over for him in the big city, and he finally found him in the middle of the marketplace. So that's significant. He's right in the middle of the marketplace. He's not in a monastery or some secluded place. So Sudana went up to him, paid his respects, and said to him, "Noble one, I have set my mind on supreme perfect enlightenment, but I do not know how to learn or carry out the practice of enlightening beings. Enlightening beings is a translation of the word bodhisattva. Please teach me the path of enlightening beings, on which path I may set out for omniscience. And omniscience means total openness to everything and everyone all the time. Ratnachuda took Sudhana to his house, and he showed him his house. And he said, look at my house. So looking the house over, Sudhana saw that it was radiant. It was made of gold. It was wide and high, surrounded by silver walls, adorned with crystal terraces, embellished with hundreds of thousands of lapis lazuli turrets on coral pillars. There was a lion seat arrayed with red pearls, flying lion banners made of starry jewels, covered with a canopy of radiant jewels, draped with a net of wish-fulfilling jewels, arrayed with countless gemstones. Are you picturing this? Right? In a very impressive place. I don't think there's a house around here anything like it. Even though there's, I know around here, fabulous houses, but nothing like this. There was also a lotus pond with cool water made of emeralds. Surrounded by trees of all kinds of jewels, the house was large, 10 stories high with 8 doors. Sudhana entered the house and looked around. On the first floor, he saw supplies of food and drink being given away. He was a very generous, wealthy person. On the second floor, he saw all kinds of clothing being given away. On the third floor, he saw all kinds of jewelry being given away. On the fourth floor, he saw royal concubines, the most talented women on earth, being given away. On the fifth floor, he saw a gathering of enlightening beings of the fifth stage, celebrating the teaching in song. So they were singing the teachings. And that must have been a beautiful singing. You know, they must have had really nice voices. Thinking and acting for the welfare and happiness of the world, practicing all sciences, putting into effect the method of mystic spells, the ocean of concentration, emergence from concentration, contemplation in concentration, and the light of knowledge. So the fifth floor was pretty impressive. On the sixth floor, he saw a gathering of enlightening beings who had attained transcendent wisdom, who had profound wisdom, who had mystic knowledge of the quiescence of all phenomena, that everything they knew, they saw, that everything was already perfectly peaceful all the time, who were completely familiar with the comprehensive method containing the method of concentration spells of the stages, whose sphere of action was unimpeded, who practiced non-dualism, who were singing also beautiful songs of the teaching. Now, you know, we are aware, I think, of Western sacred music, right? Bach wrote all kinds of sacred music, and there's beautiful music that was sung, you know, chanting and so on in the monasteries. But we don't really know the Asian spiritual music, of which there must be like vast amounts of gorgeous music. Well, that was what was happening on this floor too. Following the process of transcendent by wisdom, analyzing and opening it up, a door of transcendent wisdom called Matrix of Equality, a door of transcendent wisdom called Orderly Analysis of the Knowledge of All Sentient Beings, a door of transcendent wisdom called Unmoving, a door of transcendent wisdom called The Light of Dispassion, a door of transcendent wisdom called Invincible Matrix. And it goes on that way for some time. I'll skip a bunch, but many doors of transcendent wisdom of all kinds, and each one. So those are all the different ways that you could realize this transcendent wisdom. And notice that orderly analysis and intellectual comprehension is one of the doors. But there are many others. And at the end of that, on the sixth floor, he sees enlightening beings in untold numbers of orderly groups singing in chorus of countless tens of hundreds of thousands of such doors of transcendent wisdom. So they're singing about all these doors, beautiful songs. But he goes up to the seventh floor now, and there he saw a gathering of enlightening beings who had attained acceptance of the fact that all sounds are like echoes, who were completely familiar with ascertainment of knowledge of means. That means they knew all the ways that it would take to help people, all the ways that you could serve sentient beings and bring them to awakening. They knew every way that that could happen. And they took the multitude of teachings, they took in the multitude of teachings of all the Buddhas. On the eighth floor, he saw a gathering of enlightening beings who had attained undiminished mystic knowledge, who observed all worlds, who were able to appear reflected in all communities, whose bodies were distributed evenly throughout all universes. That means that all over the place there are these bodies of these enlightening beings. You just have to look for them. You probably passed one on your way to Kanando this morning and didn't notice it, but they're there because these people had learned how to distribute their bodies evenly throughout all universes. They perceived the presence of all Buddhas as a unified sphere. They were united with the body of all Buddhas, and they were the chief interlocutors in the audiences of all Buddhas. They were the ones who spoke the teachings. When the Buddha sat quietly, they spoke the teachings. On the ninth floor, he saw a gathering of enlightening beings who were to attain Buddhahood in one lifetime. On the tenth floor, he saw the oceans of first inspirations, practices, emancipations, and vows of all Buddhas, mystic displays of all the ways of enlightenment. The audiences of all Buddhas, the sounds of the teachings of all Buddhas, magical displays to edify all sentient beings. So that's what he saw on all the 10 floors of Ratnachudra's house. Maybe you didn't have any trouble finding the objectionable line. On the fourth floor, he saw royal concubines, the most talented women on earth, being given away. In the same breath that he gave away clothes and food, he gave away these talented concubines. So these women are like any other possession that the great spiritual benefactor possesses. He's an important, wealthy man. He possesses all these wonderful things, and he's very generous with all of them. Well, if you were soaring in the heavens, well, you came thudding back to earth when you heard that line, probably. Did you? Did you notice that? Yeah, it's hard not to notice. But of course, it does reflect the truth of the social place that women were actually in those days. It seems kind of pretty horrifying that you would be property of an eminent person and you could be given away as a gift if he felt like giving you away. That's pretty awful. But in those days, the concubines were probably pretty well off compared to other women. I think it would have been better to be a concubine, despite that, than to be a wife. Because if you were a wife, you were also somebody's possession, just the same way, except you had to do a lot of heavy work. You weren't educated and able to exercise your talents as the concubines were. And you had to bear and care for children, probably lots of them, which was a very dangerous undertaking that often would cost you your life. So that wasn't such a great deal either. And then you could be unmarried, but that was, if anything, worse than all, because then you had no position in society. You were totally vulnerable and unprotected. You could barely earn a living in any way. You had to be connected to a man to be able to live. Maybe the women in those days who were better off than any other women were the ones who were monastics. Actually, monasteries were nunneries, and monasteries were always the refuge of women who were fleeing from one or another of the horrible situations that they would have found themselves in those days. So this is no big surprise that things were quite different in the world, all over the world, 2,000 years ago when this sutra first began to appear. So objectionable as it is, we're not surprised really by this line. But if the teachings are coming out of this kind of context, if the people who channeled this sutra from the Buddha fully accepted this context and didn't even notice the problems that we notice in a second, can we trust them? Why would we pay any attention to them? Maybe just like the social conditions of 2,000 years ago, the rest of it is really not anything we should pay attention to. Or, as I said, maybe we just gloss over that. But it does make you ask yourself, at least it makes me ask myself, with all our social and material advances that are really, really good and really, really important and save lives every day and treat people with respect every day, although there's plenty of disrespect and out there still. With all of that, are we fundamentally better off than people were 2,000 years ago? I mean, are we better human beings than people were 2,000 years ago? Are we happier? Are we wiser? Are we more humane? What price have we paid for all that we have gained? It reminds me of my old friend, Gil Smolin, who's now for a long time passed away, but I always think of him. He was a world-class eye doctor, and he went to India to help the poverty-stricken and ignorant people there who had no eye care, and often people would go blind for really simple illnesses that could be easily fixed. And so he went there to help them out. And he was there ministering to them, the poor, ignorant people that they were. But after a while, he realized that he was very neurotic and critical and clumsy and basically negative and an unhappy person. And these people were very happy and wise and patient and kind. And at a certain point, he realized that when he went to India, he was like actually going there to get something more than he was going there to give something. And that's how come he started Zen practice. That's how I knew him. Because after several of those trips, he began realizing that he needed something else in his life beyond his wonderful work and reputation and money. Anyway, when you think about not only the state of women in ancient times, but the state of pretty much everybody who was not the king, it was really hard to live. It was very easy to get sick and die, or murdered, or starved to death when the harvest was not good. And that was the way everybody lived, had to live. And when you think of that, I mean, 2,000 years, actually it's not that long ago, you know? When you think about that, it does put our current problems into perspective, doesn't it? Now, not to say that we don't have problems and that we can't do a lot better than we're doing. I think we have to do a lot better than we're doing. But as bad as you might think things are at the moment, we have come a very, very long way, right? And most of, almost everything that we have achieved in all that time is not being taken away from us. We will never go back to 2,000 years ago, this despite the dire situation that we seem to be in at the moment. The 10 floors and the 8 doors of Ratnachudra's house stand for the 10 paramitas and the Eightfold Path. The 10 paramitas, I guess most of you probably know the usual 6, giving, morality, patience, energy, meditation, and prajna, transcendent wisdom. But in the Mahayana, especially in the Abhatamsaka Sutra, maybe is the originator of the idea of 10 paramitas, because it's obsessed with the number 10 somehow, the Avatamsaka Sutra. So they added 4 more paramitas: skillful means, vows, spiritual powers, and knowledge or omniscience. Those are the 10 practices of bodhisattvas, and the Eightfold Path, I think we know from the oldest form of Buddhism: right view, right resolve or intention, right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness and concentration. So that includes all of our ideas and attitudes, our ethical conduct and livelihood, as well as our meditation practice. So throughout the sutra, all the lists of ancient practices are always referenced, but they're brought into story and magnified and made more imaginative and expanded through the details of the story. So after seeing this fabulous house of Ratnachudra, Sudana says, "Wow, you know, how did you get a place like this? How did that happen?" And he said, "Well, it's because I served many, 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 many Buddhas over a long, long, long period of time. And I dedicated myself to 3 things: the ending of poverty, the hearing of all truth, and meeting all enlightened and enlightening spiritual benefactors. Those are the 3 things that I've dedicated myself to." So I thought about this, and I think it's really, really wonderful. And it goes to the essence of our aspiration in practice. Don't we all aspire to those same 3 things? Wouldn't we like to, in our heart of hearts, if we had the power, if we could, wouldn't we aspire to end all kinds of poverty in this world, economic and otherwise? Don't we really, really wish that everyone, without exception, would have something to eat every day, would have a place to live every day, a way to be cared for, body and soul, a way to be respected and loved. Don't we find it painful to know that so many people are not in that condition, even when we are? We can't be happy entirely knowing that others lack these things. And don't we also want to listen and to hear the truth all the time in everything that we say, in everything that we hear, and everything that we come to understand? And don't we also want to see always in others we meet, whether they are our Dharma teachers or anybody else that we would meet, anybody else, don't we want to see nothing but Buddhas and Bodhisattvas? So that we are living in a world where whenever we see another sentient being, we feel a trust and a love for that person or even that non-human being, knowing that we're all on the same path of awakening together. That's the world of Ratnachuda and of this sutra. Trust and love are wonderful words. But they're also a little difficult in a way. When we hear them, usually we feel good, or I hope anyway, we feel good. But at the same time, while we certainly all know what these words mean, we don't really, really know what they mean, do we? And I wonder how easy it is for us to actually feel them, so that they're not just words and ideas, but actual feelings that we have. To read them, to hear them, to think about them, to contemplate them is good. I think it's helpful to us. But I'm afraid maybe not enough for us. So everybody knows how much we cherish in our practice Zazen. And everybody knows here that Dogen's idea of Zazen is not that Zazen is a form of meditation that we should practice and get good at, a way to learn mental focus and calm. That's not what Dogen tells us is Zazen in our tradition, nor is it a path to become enlightened at some future date. For Dogen, Zazen is just sitting in the middle of this love and trust that is fundamentally what we are as human beings. And when we sit in Zazen, even if we don't know how to do it very well, or we don't know why we're doing it or that this is what it is, we're just sort of sitting there willy-nilly, we have no idea what we're doing or what's going on. Even so, if we keep it up, little by little, our hearts can't help but relax. And we will have the capacity to allow what is best in truest in us to come forward. Little by little, we have the courage to allow this to happen. Because it takes courage to love and to trust. It takes a lot of confidence within to know that we can love and trust. We don't have to be afraid. And that we are worthy ourselves of love and trust. Because we have so much inner fear. It's so ingrained in us, so much of a sense that we have to protect and defend ourselves almost all the time with almost everybody we meet. So whether you have been rolling your eyes when you hear about this outrageous Mahayana Sutra or not, some people I know think, oh man, Zen is the opposite of this. Why is he talking about this? Other people enjoy it. I enjoy it. I mean, I'm glad that I can stop studying at some point and study something else, but I enjoy it. One way or the other, if you practice Zazen, you don't need the sutra. Your life will be the sutra. You will be a blessing for others. This is really something, you know. I'm sure everybody here can think of someone in your life who was a blessing, you know, for you. Just knowing them was a blessing, and they were that kind of a person. People who knew them felt happy to know them. You will be that person if you continue to do Zazen. You will be a source of inspiration and blessings for others. You might not believe me, but it is true. It takes a while, yes. It takes support, yes. It's not a magic pill, you know, Zazen. Zazen exists in a whole context of community and support and teaching. But it does have that effect on us. And that's a blessing for our lives, the lives of those around us, and for the world. So that's what I wanted to share with you this morning. Maybe this all took longer than usual, but let's allow maybe 10 minutes. If anybody has anything they'd like to say or bring up, we can maybe, is that okay? Take 10 more minutes? Just 10.
Yes.
I'll limit it for sure to 10 minutes. So, yes.
Thank you so much for your talk. When you think about trust and love, things happen in life where, you know, that gets shaken. You trust somebody and then that gets broken, or, you know, love gets shaken up. How do you use Zen practice to regain that trust and love in your
life? Yes, well, that's a great question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's saying, yeah, of course we talk about trust and love, but it happens all the time in life. Somebody you trust betrays you, and then your trust is shattered, and how do you regain that in your practice? Yeah. Well, that's a really, really important question, because the trust here of a bodhisattva goes beyond the ordinary trust that we have. Because the ordinary trust that we have is, I trust someone to be a certain way. I assume that they are, I trust them to be that way, they turned out not to be that way. But the bodhisattva, I always say, I trust everyone all the time. I really do. I trust them all the time to be who they are. Right? People are going to be who they are. I don't need people to be somebody else. That's the bodhisattva trust, to trust people to be who they are. And of course, people have been knocked around terribly. And so, of course, I would say most of the people in the world, the vast majority, are incapable of truly trustworthy conduct because they've been knocked around. So, of course, that's the way it is. So we have to be able to see other people as they are and trust them to be who they are. And then I think when we understand that and we contemplate that, and in our own practice, you know, we look at ourselves, one of the things that happens on the cushion is you get to see how deeply messed up you are, except for you, but the rest of us. Very messed up, you know, and all kinds of twisted thoughts. And you sit there, and you breathe, and you're still alive, and it's okay, right? You forgive yourself. Eventually, you forgive yourself for all of that. And you know, I think this way because of this. I am this way because of that. I understand, and I can't help it. Then you look at somebody else. It's just the same. So you trust them, always trust them. And sometimes, you know, you trust them and you have your hand on your wallet because you know that they're a thief and you don't want them to steal your wallet. So, you know, that doesn't mean that you don't have your hand on your wallet or whatever you the equivalent is that you need to do. But you don't need to do that with a sense of people are not worthy of respect and they're not beautiful Buddhas. They're beautiful Buddhas who have been knocked around and are going to do some bad stuff for a certain amount of time before they get over it. So this is a very big sort of, it goes way beyond our ordinary ideas of trust and love. That's the whole thing. It goes way beyond. If you have universal love, that's a different kind of love than I love my friends. I love my family. It's a different kind of love if you love all sentient beings. So, and it's something that we, you know, we hear these teachings again and again, we think about them, we sit, and little by little by little, over time, our view changes. So there's no way to do it, you know, just do this, and then you'll, no, it's not like that. It's like, keep on with the path, keep listening to the teachings, keep using your intelligence, keep thinking, keep observing what happens in life. For instance, you know, if someone hurts me, and I am very angry with them, and time goes by, and I have a real grudge against them, I can't help but notice that they're going about their business happily. They don't care. I, on the other hand, have got this horrible feeling inside that's with me all the time. Well, that doesn't make sense, right? Even though they're bad people and they did this to me, yeah, that's all true. But does it make sense for them to be happily going along and you to be suffering? No, it doesn't make sense. You begin to notice these type of things. You see it for yourself from your own experience. It's our own suffering and our own confusion that is our number one teacher. And then you start hearing the teaching, you say, yeah, maybe I don't have to hold this grudge. Maybe that doesn't make sense. I don't have to go up to the person and say, oh, I forgive you, I love you. No, I don't forgive them and I don't love them. But I don't need to hold this bad feeling in my heart. It doesn't make sense. So we learn little by little. Yeah, I mean, the world is full of rotten people, let's be honest, you know. Full of rotten people. It's so interesting and colorful, you know, these people. But, yeah, let's take care of ourselves, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 10 minutes, yeah.
So I was reflecting on something that has come up for me various times in the practice, like when you were talking about this, you know, having a problem with the teaching, problem with the idea of giving away concubines, and various issues oftentimes with sexism and the teachings over the years, and other things just in general, like, you know, when you can see, oh, I really trust this teacher, and they still have their karma. Like, I remember somebody telling me early on in my practice, like, don't get stuck in the teacher's karma. Like, I found that really helpful. I could say, okay, you know, what am I learning from the teacher that's helpful, and I don't need to pay attention to the stuff that I find really problematic unless it's directly affecting my ability to kind of engage with what is helpful. And I remember having a conversation with Rabbi Anderson about even the stories of Shakyamuni Buddha himself and how he, you know, was so close to the idea initially of Mahapajapati being ordained and women being able to practice at all and so on. And it's like, we don't know if that's true, but I was having this issue where it's like, if he's supposed to be enlightened and he's also sexist, how does this work? And, you know, it was kind of a similar thing where he was saying, well, it's kind of like, that's his karma and it's okay, he can still have that. And at the same time, it's sort of like, if Zazen is this verb of practice enlightenment, if you're, it's not that you're an enlightened person, it's that you are engaging.
Yes.
You're not. Yeah, it somehow kind of worked out for me. So that's just sort of a reflection coming up.
Yeah.
I think about what you were saying.
Yeah. Well, at the risk of going past the 10 minutes, I'll try to make this quick. There are no enlightened persons, of course, right? There are no persons, right? So there's no Buddha apart from everybody and everything else. There's no Buddha. Buddha is in the context. So my reading of that story of why does Buddha not approve of the ordination of Maha Prajapati right away? Is he a sexist and all that? I think that has nothing to do with it, in my opinion. Nothing to do with it. That's projecting our modern views onto what it is that my version of it is that the reason why is because we needed this story of Buddha and Ananda and Maha Prajapati. And this is all one story and one person. It's not three people, it's one person. And Buddha is enlightened, and enlightened people don't even notice anybody else. They're too beyond. So who cares whether Maha Prajapati gets ordained or not? Ananda is not enlightened. The enlightened, this is Dogen. Dogen says we need enlightened and non-enlightenment. We need the enlightened and the non-enlightenment to have this world. So it needed to happen that Ananda came up and said, and why did Ananda intercede on behalf of Maha Prajapati? Out of affection. Out of affection and a sense of fairness, which is not at all enlightened. You know, Buddha didn't have those things. We needed Ananda, the unenlightened person, to come in and say, so we need that for ourselves. We need art. We need to be enlightened, and also we need to be unenlightened. If we were only enlightened, we would not really, it wouldn't be good. We would be too abstract, you know. No, we have to have, for Dogen, enlightenment is beyond enlightenment. He says, right? It's enlightenment beyond enlightenment. It's all together. It's the whole picture. The whole picture is like that. So we need all parts of it, even the confusion. And that's the hardest thing to realize. We want everything to be perfect. There's no such thing. Yes, May, last thought.
No.
I think we have to go beyond beliefs, yeah.
So this sutra, is it still in Iranian religion or it's beyond religion?
Oh, I don't know. I guess you'd have to say officially it's a religious text, part of a religion called Mahayana Buddhism. But let's read it in a bigger scope than that, because it certainly intends to be a bigger scope than that, yeah. Anybody online have a quick thought before we go? Ah, Philip. So Philip, he did it, unmute himself, yeah. And
can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
You say you're bringing up the fourth floor of the house, and I remember just a few weeks ago starting to read the sutra, how ubiquitous the sexual activity was. With the concubines seem to appear on just very regularly.
Yeah.
And it reminded me so much of when I came of age in the 60s.
Uh-huh.
And the ideology, or the more than that, the spirituality of sexuality was so strong.
Yeah.
Of course, it was a sexist time as well. But there's an element of spiritualizing sexuality, I guess, that existed in the 1960s and exists in the culture and in this, obviously in this culture that's beyond, I think, an issue of sexism, but it's kind of unique to this. I mean, it certainly includes that aspect. I was just struck about a religious vision that incorporated a. What they call nowadays a pansexual, but there's a term for polyamorous,
uh-huh.
Sexuality that goes beyond the conventional sexuality, and that there is something a glimmer of that anyhow in this sutra that, that is challenging and I think worth taking seriously. But anyhow,
Yeah. Well, I think in as far as I'm remembering, the concubines and all that, that's a worldly... that's not what the sutra is advocating. It mentions it because wealthy people had concubines. That was the social condition. But yes, I think that my impression is that the spiritual and sexual combination of the 60s didn't work out that well. And I think that we've come to... I think there's a reason why sexuality is so powerfully fraught. I think it is something that a great deal of care has to be taken with. And we do have the precept of... this has got different interpretations and translations, but the way we understand it is to respect others, not to misuse sexuality. So that means taking a great deal of care. So I don't know that Buddhism would be compatible with or promoting polyamory. But then again, I know absolutely nothing about polyamory or its customs or rules and so on. I do know once I talked to somebody who was not a polyamory person, but a kink person. You know, like weird, what I would consider weird or unusual sexual practices. And she told me that there's an organized community of people who do that, and they have rules, and, you know, they have ways to keep each other safe and so on. So, I don't know. It's a complicated world. But, whew. Yeah. Well, thanks, Philip. Thanks, everybody. Take care of yourselves. Let's chant and say goodbye.
Recording stopped.
Hey.